There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and this is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we enter into those conversations as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind or another general opinion piece, but they very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So I think you're just the person to give it to them. So we invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. You'll get lots of information and commentary we don't have time to share here on the hour at this time of day. But hey, around the clock, we got stuff going on, and we put it out there on the website at reconnectwithcarmen.com, and you can go and download it there. You can also connect with us on Facebook. We are The Reconnect, and let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. All right, friends, I want to lead off today with a conversation about the United States and its relationship with Korea, both South and North. So the United States and South Korea are currently engaged in their annual joint exercises. Now, these joint exercises are designed to prepare our troops for the prospect that the war with North Korea, which is, you know, been on hold now for 50 some years, it could turn from cold to hot at any moment. These drills have been a regular part of the United States and South Korea's readiness for a long time. But with heightened tensions between North Korea and the United States, the drills take on what folks would consider potentially greater importance. And so if you were to look at the New York Times, you'd see an article entitled South Korea and the United States Begin Drills as North Warns of Rising Tensions. The lead paragraph is this. This is from Seoul, South Korea. The United States and South Korea began their annual joint military exercises on Monday, while North Korea warned that the drills would deepen tensions on the Korean Peninsula by, quote, throwing fuel into fire. So both the United States and South Korea insist that the drills are defensive in nature, but North Korea has long condemned these joint exercises, viewing them as rehearsals for invasion. So during these drills, North Korea has often escalated its warlike rhetoric and lashed out with missile and other weapons tests. Now, you can imagine in the current context of things, that is just simply not acceptable. So the next piece from the New York Times on the same subject is a news analysis piece by David Sanger, and it's entitled Talk of Preventative War Rises in the White House Over North Korea. Here's the lead paragraph from that article. Not since 2002, as the United States built a case for war in Iraq, has there been so much debate inside the White House about the merits and the enormous risks of preemptive military action against an adversary nation. So the adversary nation in this case is North Korea, but the language that's being tossed about is not just preemptive military action, but a concept that General H.R. McMaster is characterizing as preventive war. Preventive war is the language. He says he's going to ask and answer his own question here in this quote. Are we preparing plans for a preventive war? General McMaster asked recently in a television interview, defining the term as, quote, a war that would prevent North Korea from threatening the United States with a nuclear weapon. He then went on to answer his own question. The president's been very clear about it, he said. He's not going to tolerate North Korea being able to threaten the United States. So now, exactly what does that mean, and exactly where does that mean we stand? Well, former Director of National Security James Clapper, in an interview following Trump's speech just a couple of nights ago for his 2020 reelection campaign rally in Phoenix, Arizona, he actually said that he's fearful of the fact that this particular president controls the nuclear launch capabilities of the United States. So I've got a couple of clips from James Clapper's interview, and here we go.
You know, I've toiled in one capacity or another for every president since and including John F. Kennedy through President Obama. And I don't know when I've listened and watched something like this from a president that I found more disturbing. Having some understanding of the the levers of power that are available to a president if he chooses to exercise them. I found this downright scary and disturbing.
Is he a threat to national security, the president?
Well, he certainly could be. Again, having some understanding of the levers that a president can exercise, I worry about, frankly, the access to nuclear codes. If he, in a fit of pique, he decides to do something about Kim Jong-un, there's actually very little to stop him. The whole system's built to ensure a rapid response if necessary. So there are very little in the way of controls over exercising a nuclear option, which is pretty damn scary.
All right, friends. So when we think about guys who have a hard time sleeping because other guys are in charge of things that they know a whole lot more about than we do, one of my friends on Twitter was like, okay, if James Clapper's not sleeping, I'm not sleeping. Like, I can't sleep if that guy can't sleep. So I guess that's the question that we are left with, right? We have we basically have this agreement with North Korea that they are not going to aggress against their southern neighbor, South Korea, and that we are going to stand there with South Korea to be sure that doesn't happen. But we're now at the place where the approach, the possibilities related to what North Korea might do are not only in relationship to their southern neighbor. We're not just talking about a million North Koreans marching across the demilitarized zone and invading a South Korea with a willingness to lose a million North Korean lives in the effort. We're talking about a nuclear capable North Korea. And so that really does change the calculus of the conversation. And particularly when you start talking about nuclear war, you got to be having a very sober conversation with you and your family and your friends about, what does that really mean? What are we really talking about? And is it something that we should be talking about with any sort of casualness whatsoever? And so I just think that as Christians, this is one of those conversations where we have the opportunity to be people, first of all, who are not afraid. We're not going to be people who live in fear. We are going to be people who are not going to be, we're not going to allow North Korean terrorists to terrorize us, which means they would change the way that we would be living. They would change the way that we go about our everyday lives because we are so afraid that, in fact, they might detonate some kind of nuclear weapon either over our atmosphere with an EMP or actually on terra firma itself. So here's what I want you to be thinking about. I want you to be thinking about sort of your view of nuclear power and your view of nuclear weapons and your view of the right and responsibility of the President of the United States and those who are around him to be very serious about these considerations when they talk about any kind of war, and certainly when they talk about the use of any kind of nuclear power. Even the Pope, actually a number of successive popes since the mid-1950s, have basically said, look, nuclear weapons change the ethical calculus of war. And so even when you talk to just war theorists, you gotta recognize that most of them are not considering the nuclear option. It's just not an option for Christians to even consider. I'm wondering if you know that both of the pilots of the planes that ultimately dropped nuclear bombs in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, that those guys were Christians. I wonder if you know that they were prayed for by Christian military chaplains before they took off on that mission. And I wonder if you know that thousands of the people who died were actually members of a church. I wonder if you know that the main bastion of Japanese Christianity, a tradition that survived harsh persecution between 1600 and 1850, I wonder if you know that it was their cathedral that was basically ground zero for one of those bombs, that 8,500 of our brothers and sisters in Christ died as a direct or indirect result of the American dropping of the atomic bomb on Japan. And so it doesn't just change the calculus for us when we start talking about our own lives. It changes the calculus for us as Christians as we consider the reality that we have brothers and sisters around the globe, people who belong to Christ in North Korea and for whom God is ultimately concerned about their salvation. So I just want you to consider those things in your conversations as you talk with others about these various serious matters of our day. All right, friends, the White House has also issued a memo that sort of begins the process of setting the rules for the transgender ban in the military. You will remember that it was a few weeks ago that the president tweeted out that, you know, we were not going to have any more transgender members of the military. And so the response to that was, well, sir, you can say that, but there's got to be some kind of policy around that. And right now, that's not what we got going on. Well, here's where we're at now. And I'll just read this statement to you. The White House is now expected to send guidance to the Pentagon on how to implement the new administration ban on transgender people in the military. So the policy would allow the Defense Secretary, Jim Mattis, to consider a service member's ability to deploy in deciding whether or not to allow them to continue to serve in the military. And then there's this. The White House memo also directs the Pentagon to deny admittance to transgender individuals and to stop spending on medical treatment regimens for those currently serving. Okay, this is a flashpoint. This is a hot button issue. This is something that we as a culture have to learn to talk about in ways that honor the dignity of every person, but also recognize that gender dysphoria is a psychological impairment. It's a disorder. It's called dysphoria, gender dysphoria. It means that you are out of alignment. You are thinking in such a way that you are not accepting the reality of the physical body that you have. And so when we start having these conversations in our culture and this overwhelming, there's an overwhelming, I don't know, pressure maybe is the word, to not only accept that transgenderism is legitimate, but to celebrate it and to indoctrinate our children into thinking that if a boy presents as a girl, we now have to call him by the girl name and we have to use female pronouns and we have to treat him as a girl. And you say to yourself, well, I mean, you know, this is a pretty adult conversation. Well, maybe you haven't yet heard about what's happening just outside of Sacramento, California. A charter school there had an experience this past Monday where a kindergarten teacher brought in picture books about transgenderism. The effort was to affirm a gender dysphoric student. Gender dysphoric student means there's a kid in that class who is presenting as a gender other than the one they were born with. Okay, so during the class, the gender dysphoric boy switched into clothes to look more like a girl, and then there was what is described as a gender reveal. Now, there are two things of concern here. My number one concern is that parents were not notified in advance that this was going to be happening. And then other teachers and the school district itself, the administration, defended the teacher's right to use the books that she had used and to not inform parents in advance that this would be happening. Why not? Well, because come to find out, sex education content requires parental notification. But classroom instruction related to gender identity, so-called SOGI, sexual orientation and gender identity educational materials, not only are parents not required to be informed in advance, they can't opt out. So you can't give parents an opt-out option and you can't tell them in advance that they can't opt out. So parents are being intentionally kept in the dark in terms of what's being taught to their children and the indoctrination that's taking place in relationship to these gender identity, this gender dysphoria issue in our culture today. So I want you to imagine for a moment, you sent your little kindergartner off. She's 5 years old. She's got her pigtails and her pink dress or whatever it is that she went marching off in, off to school this year. And she comes home and she's terrified now to go into the bathroom by herself. And you can't figure out why. And so finally, she tells you, well, it's because Bobby went into the bathroom and came out as Betty. And that's what our teacher said. You could go in and you can change and you can be whatever you want to be. And I don't want to be a boy. And I'm afraid if I go into the bathroom, I'm going to turn into a boy. Now, five-year-old children think very literally. And so Bobby went in as Bobby and he came out as Betty, and little kids do not have the capacity to differentiate what's going on there. So for them, there is no make-believe. For you and I, we both know that is all make-believe. And so this mirrors a situation in Minnesota. If you thought, oh, well, that's just California and wacky stuff happens out there all the time. This is mirrored in a situation in Minnesota where there have been 16 months of litigation against a charter school. And the settlement that the school has now agreed to requires them to make all uniforms available to both sexes, to pay LGBT organizations to train their staff in politically correct behavior every 3 years, and to not adopt any gender policy that allows parents to opt out of requirements in the gender inclusion policy if their objection based on religion or conscience. So I got to tell you, if you thought that that as a Christian you were going to be able to opt out of things that that were going on in relationship to this sexual orientation, gender identity revolution in our country, you no longer have the option to opt out of your child being indoctrinated into this teaching if in fact they happen to be in public schools or charter schools at this point in time. Now, here's the real challenge. We know that activists are already working to require all public, private, and eventually home schools to teach children these false ideas that sexuality is malleable and that transgenderism is not only real, but should be celebrated and embraced. And here is, I think, the best evidence out there today that that transgenderism is a myth. If you've been looking for evidence that, you know, if that plays out over time, that this is a myth, I want to direct you to a guy whose name is Walt Heyer, H-E-Y-E-R. He's got a website. He's probably got a book. I don't really know that, but he's a public speaker, and he's got a website, and it's waltheyer.com, and H-E-Y-E-R. Here's why I'm sharing Walt's story with you. Walt actually had a sex change operation. He went through the entire process of cross-gender hormones and genital surgery to change himself from a boy into a girl. Here's the problem. And he publishes this at sexchangeregret.com, which is his blog. It's not real. It's not real. He says this: underneath all the cosmetic procedures, vocal training, and hair growth or hair removal lies a physical reality. Biologically, the person has not changed from a man into a woman or vice versa. He talks a lot about the reality of the underlying biology of who we are as men and women. He says this: sex pertains to the two different ways males and females are structured for reproduction. And these structures are permanently ingrained in your biology. They cannot be chosen at will. A man can mutilate his body, and I did, but he can never transform it to be organized as a female. Vice versa for women. He says this makes sense of the head snapping and false headline many of us saw about a man having a baby. The man featured in the story is simply a biological woman who kept her childbearing anatomy intact. He says, my sex change, and he puts that in quotes, my sex change surgery from male to female, talks about the doctor who performed that and who told him that this was going to fulfill his desire to be a woman. He now says that surgeon is willing to write a letter to the court saying that I meet the medical criteria to legally change my birth certificate back to male. He says the very surgeon who earlier said that hormones and surgery would change me to female now admits it does not do that. He says the doctor testified that the surgery and cross-gender hormones have the effect of neutering external appearance and genitalia, but internal biological structures and genetics remain the same. Men are men, women are women, but false hope abounds. Walt Heyer talks about the growing number of people like himself who recognize that what has happened to them because of a false hope, what has happened to them is radical, irreversible, unnecessary genital mutilation surgeries. And he says, if you really want to come alongside someone and help them resolve their gender dysphoria, please encourage them not to have destructive body mutilating surgeries that are a waste of time and money. He says, after medically certified gender changes, life doesn't actually improve and gender dysphoria is persistent. The feeling of unease with one's gender persists. It is not relieved as promised by neither gender hormones nor by surgery. So there are people out there in the world who are testifying to the false hope of transgenderism. And I just want to, I want us to be sort of praying the news today on these two fronts related to kids who are being exposed in school this year to information about all kinds of things, gender dysphoria being one of them, sexual identity issues being just one of them. But there are lots of kids being exposed to stuff this semester as they enter back into school related to race or racism or white supremacy. There are kids who are encountering information that is very challenging to the way that they think about creation and evolution. And there's certainly going to be information that's shared with your kids with which you profoundly disagree. And so I really want you to engage in these conversations in ways that both honor Jesus and respect the reality that children are a sacred trust. Their minds are malleable. They are still, in fact, growing up. And it's your responsibility as their parents and grandparents and other Christians of influence in their lives to live out the reality of God's calling. And that calling is that we would train up children in the way that they should go, that we would actually train them up. You might think of that as indoctrination. It's also called discipleship. And so you have a profound responsibility to make God known to your child. There's no greater thing that you're going to do in this life than make God known to the next generation. And so how are you going to go about doing that? Well, you certainly can't put your own light under a bushel. And you probably need some equipping. So we actually have a special resource posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com on gender identity and gender confusion. It brings together conversations that we've had on this particular subject with Andrew Walker, Rod Dreher, Owen Strachan, and Denny Burke. So if you go to reconnectwithcarmen.com, you can download the free gender identity and gender confusion special report. It's called a special report, and you click on it, and it's all of those interviews aggregated together to help you be prepared to talk to your children about these very, very challenging issues of the day. All right, friends, these are certainly challenging days for us. They are challenging days for others around the globe. I simply want to lift up these two concerns in terms of other parents and other places dealing with horrific realities. Would you pray today for parents in the countries of Yemen and Nigeria? In Yemen, there is a cholera outbreak, the likes of which we have really not seen in generations. Parents there are describing it as a slow death. UNICEF describes it as the world's worst humanitarian crisis in a generation. There are literally children dying every hour of every day. And so, children will die during the hour that you are listening to this, either on the air or via podcast. So let's pray for those parents. They have no access to the clean water that they need. They have no access to the food that they need because they live in a failed state. The other set of parents I want you to pray for, group of parents, are parents in Nigeria. I don't know if you are aware of what Boko Haram is doing in Nigeria, but the activities of Boko Haram, which is a terrorist affiliate of ISIS, they are turning children into suicide bombers, and this issue is at an all-time high in the Lake Chad region of northeast Nigeria. We're talking about at least 83 kids since January who have been strapped with bombs and sent into public gathering places to be detonated. The children are detonated. And I don't even know how to wrap my heart and mind around that, but I know that God knows each and every one of those precious children and knows their parents as well. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. It's a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. So join us at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, become a reconnector, our ministry partners who prayerfully and financially support us as we seek to expand the reach of this ministry to more and more people. You can find out more information at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Hey, friends, in the ultimate game of hide and seek, grace always finds us. Isn't that a wonderful, wonderful comfort and testimony of mercy, the mercy of God in our lives that Jesus came to seek and to save the lost. So if you're hiding from him today, man, just go ahead and let yourself be found. That'd be my encouragement to you this afternoon. Hey, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect. We are putting God in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about. We're equipping you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And we invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can let us know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. While you're at the website, I'd invite you to sign up for the email list, and we'll send you some timely equipping resources designed to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring God back into the conversations that you're having in ways that honor Jesus. So the website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. So I'm excited to have with me today Reverend Michael Spurlock. He's currently on the clergy staff at St. Thomas Church, Fifth Avenue in New York City, but he previously served as vicar of All Saints Episcopal Church in Smyrna, Tennessee. Now, what we are going to talk about today is actually a movie called All Saints, the surprising story of how refugees from Burma brought life to a dying church. There's a movie based on that book. It's a remarkable story about a congregation that, frankly, is a lot like a lot of our mainline Episcopal, Presbyterian, other varieties of mainline churches in the country where they had a dwindling membership. They had a mortgage that was certainly more than they could bear, and they had a choice to make. And this is a good news story of God's redemption of a particular congregation and also the transformation of the hearts and minds of the people. So I'm excited to be hearing the story from the pastor who actually walked with his people through it, and then we can talk about the movie as well. Welcome to The Reconnect.
Thank you, Carmen. It's great to be here.
Take us back to the time when you were new to the pastorate. The church was struggling. Tough decisions needed to be made. Tell us your story from your time at All Saints.
Well, as you said, I confronted a congregation that was sparsely attended and heavily indebted. And very quickly, myself and the diocesan leadership determined there was probably no other alternative but to sell the property to cover the debt. And then the thought was we would replant the church from scratch and maybe rent a storefront to worship in. We set those wheels in motion. In the time that we were preparing the church for sale to put it on the market, then right after Easter in 2008, a small family of folks that I would later discover were Karen, K-A-R-E-N, an ethnic group from Burma, showed up at the front door one day and wanted to talk to me.
So these were former farmers from Burma, the Karen people. They were looking
That's
for
right.
a fresh start in America. Were they Christians?
They were, and they were Anglican Christians, they were part of our denomination. They were classified as political refugees. The Karen live in the eastern part of Burma, and ever since World War II, they had been persecuted by the Burmese government, both for their ethnicity and their Christianity. And so when they came to us, they had been relocated by the government, classified as political refugees, out of these refugee camps that bordered Thailand and Burma. They would flee to the refugee camps and from there would be resettled.
Now, I'm curious, how does Smyrna, Tennessee compare with their experience in Burma or the refugee camp on the border of Thailand? I think that it's helpful for people to consider the difference between immigrants and refugees in this conversation. You talk about, you know, people being classified as political refugees. When these people arrived in America, they want a fresh start. They are Christians. Mm-hmm. They're Anglican. Just kind of talk with us a little bit about your experience, what you learned about all of that in this process.
Well, this is an issue that seems to be very much at the forefront of folks' minds these days. And one thing I learned is that, folks who flee their homelands, especially because of persecution, don't want this to be happening to them. They would like to live at home, at peace, and go about their business, but circumstances beyond their control and intervene. And these are often life and death circumstances, dangerous circumstances that they're confronted with. So, if self-survival means anything to you, complacency is not an option. You either stay and die, or you flee and live. And the problem for us is, when we're on the receiving end of that, is that we inherit folks who have fled with against their own will, as it were, and all they want to do is, like you say, make a good start of it in the new land, if folks will permit them to do so.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, because, not every congregation is necessarily ready to extend this kind of hospitality to people from a different part of the world who look mm-hmm. and sound and speak and maybe have cultural practices very different than their own. Talk with us about, the 25 or so folks who were at All Saints, with whom you were having these conversations about the prospect maybe of shutting down the church, selling the property, mm-hmm. Replanting in a storefront, and then God sends these farmers from Southeast Asia. Tell us about the interaction between the refugees and then your interaction with the existing congregation. Just talk with us about that experience.
Well, the first part of it was helping my congregation reconcile itself to the fact that they were going to lose their church. And that was one set of conversations. That move was reluctantly accepted because the writing was on the wall. The math didn't add up there. And while folks were sad about leaving, they sort of looked at the circumstances and said, we see that there really is no option. We stay, go into default on the mortgage. We're going to lose it anyway. Better to sell and leave and try to make a fresh start. So that was one conversation that was going on. Then the refugees came and they said, we need help with food, clothing, transportation, medical care, employment, et cetera, and we'd like to come to church with you. Immediately, I'm thinking, my existing congregation has problems of its own. I don't know how we're going to take on an overwhelming ministry to refugees. But then this is the critical thing is that you asked or suggested that not many congregations are prepared to do this for a number of reasons. One thing that I have learned through the study of Scripture is that God is a lover of strangers, and he has almost a preferential love for the refugee. And his own son was a refugee during Mary, Joseph, and Jesus' sojourn in Egypt when they were fleeing Herod's soldiers in Bethlehem. So God has experienced this in his own family. What do you do? Do you say no? You'll just have to go someplace else. We can't help you. Or do you say, I'm not going to vex you. I'm going to welcome you. And we'll figure it out. And that's what I said to them is, look, I don't know how this is going to work out. But you come on, go to church with us, and we'll figure it out together. And then a whole nother set of conversations began happening in the church when suddenly we went from about 40 members by the time the Corinne showed up to over 100 members in the church.
Folks, we're having a conversation with Reverend Michael Spurlock. He was the pastor or the vicar of the All Saints Episcopal Church in Smyrna, Tennessee, which is now the subject of a new movie. It's called All Saints, and you can check it out at allsaintsmovie.com. You can follow the movie on Twitter at All Saints Movie. And we're talking about the pastor's experience of living it. So the movie captures some things of the story, and we're trying to capture other parts of it as well. Tell me how you feel about the casting of All Saints.
Well, the casting was a bit of a mystery to me at first, but then when I got to meet the cast, John Corbett and Cara Buono, Nelson Lee and others, it was inspired in a lot of ways. throughout our my time at All Saints, God always seemed to send us the right resource or the right person or the right skill or even the right material resource that we needed when we needed it. And John is a Christian. He gets this movie on an interior level. Kara, I believe her husband is extremely involved in philanthropic activities, helping underprivileged folks, and Kara is involved in that. And God just sent the right people at the right time to tell the story. And that makes me very comfortable because I wanted it to be in good hands. I didn't want to have folks just going through the motions, but that somehow they would understand what story it was that they were telling. Because it's God's story. It's not mine. It's not ours. This was the story of God's activity in our life, and that needed special people, and God sent them.
So do you have a favorite scene from the film?
The scenes between the Michael character and the Ye Win character, and Ye Win is the leader of the Karen community there. He was the first person who came to talk to me. And is sort of my opposite number in real life and in the film. The scenes between Ye Win and Michael were very affecting to me because it brought back so many memories of working alongside Ye Win, you know, shoulder to shoulder, trying to figure this great mystery out together. And so all those interactions were very special to me.
You know, one of the things that I observe, having had a number of years of experience in the Presbyterian Church USA, so, you know, similar in many ways to the Episcopal Church.
Right.
One of the things that I observe is that, you know, I don't feel like our mainline congregations would be lacking in members if we had simply been really open early on to the amazing tidal wave of people from around the world where our denominations planted churches over many, many decades and centuries. If we had been open to receiving people who shared our faith but looked very differently than us and have very different experiences. So talk with us a little bit about, you know, kind of the wake-up call that this might be for mainline churches across the country. Talk about maybe what you hope people are going to experience in this movie, but then maybe how you hope it's going to inspire conversations and change in local communities.
Right. One of the ironic things about my experience at All Saints is that I was sent to a semi-rural mainline denomination church in Tennessee. And it was there that I engaged in foreign missions. Only the mission came to me rather than me going overseas to pursue mission there. And we know this is happening all over the place, all the time. There are folks who are coming from different lands, and we have a ripe mission field right there amongst immigrants and refugees, and they need Christ just as much as we do. So there's that. But then there's also this wonderful thing that happened in that we weren't doing so well, and it was the arrival of these foreigners, these strangers, that revitalized our church. And for that, I'll always be grateful. And I think it ought to prick our pride a little bit in thinking that the Western church is the answer to foreign salvation. Could be foreigners who is the answer to our salvation. They inspire us to mission. They call us back to gospel imperatives, to make disciples, to preach the gospel unapologetically and with great fervor and zeal, to care for strangers, as Jesus was so often concerned with doing, to reach out to help, to live out our faith, not just to be speakers of the word, but doers of it as well. And there could be, if we did what we at All Saints stumbled into this, so this was not by design, it was by God's providence, but if things like that happened in many more churches, there'd be revival in this land like we've never seen before.
Amen. I remember an experience that I had in rural Georgia where there was this is now dates me. This goes back 20 some years. But there was this wave of immigrants from they were Lao. And so they had fled persecution in their own country. And somehow they ended up in rural Georgia, rural Northeast mm-hmm. Georgia. And they were willing to do work in chicken processing plants that, frankly, a lot of other people were not willing to do. And so there was a very, very large community of them. And they were Christians. And so they, in this case, showed up to a Presbyterian church. And the revitalization that you're talking about is precisely the story that happened there. You know, it was a very small, struggling congregation. And now, I mean, it's got a vibrant, multi-generational, multi ethnic ministry, but there were some growing pains along the way, and I admit that. And one of the things that I remember walking through with them as a little bit of an outsider, because I was not in a ministry position in that local congregation, but more broadly in that presbytery, was the conversations where you had to help the Americans actually dissect their sort of Americana stuff from stuff that was distinctively Christian, because the Lao mm-hmm. people knew the distinctively Christian stuff and they didn't get why there was all this Americana mixed in with it. And so it was a very, very interesting process of sort of sorting out what is distinctively Christian and how has that been kind of muddied up along the way with things that are really, really Western Americana.
Right. I give you the perfect example of that. It's a small example, but I think it nails it. There was a woman in the parish who really did struggle with her church changing. Its face was changing. Its emphasis was changing. And the Korinne wore their hats in church, that they took their shoes off when they came in. And it drove her crazy that they were wearing hats in church. And she used to ride me all the time. Michael, when are you going to tell them to get those hats off when they come in the door? And that what I had discovered was that they left their hats on, but they took their shoes off because to approach the altar was to approach holy ground. So I told her, Ruth, when you begin taking your shoes off to receive communion, I'll tell them to take their hats off when they come in the church.
Oh, I love it. All right, friends, we are having a privileged conversation with Reverend Michael Spurlock. It's his story. It's the story of the church that God had him shepherding at the time that is featured in the All Saints movie. The book is All Saints, the surprising story of how refugees from Burma brought life back to a dying church. The movie is called All Saints. You can check it out at allsaintsmovie.com. You can also follow them on Twitter at All Saints Movie. Father Spurlock, thank you so much for joining us today on the Reconnect.
Oh, Carmen, it was a real pleasure. A good conversation. Thank you.
All right, friends, at this point in the show, we like to go below the fold, lift up stories, and make connections designed to help you start and engage with others in conversations that may not initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles can change not only the conversation, but the course of another person's thinking and maybe even their living. So I have a subject matter that I want to talk with you about here in the Below the Fold. We have talked about it frequently here on the Reconnect, and it is the conversation about the end of life. It's a conversation about an increasing frequency of what we would call euthanasia laws, or that are now euphemistically described as, you know, death with dignity or the right to die kinds of legislation around the country. And so when we have this glamorized or glorified in the international press, I lift it up for you because there are some places around the world where people are euthanized, making the choice to end their lives, as really now just a sort of the planning that goes along with, you know, are you going to be cremated or buried? And, and what's your will look like in terms of your family and their financial future? So yeah, I'm going to lift up one of those stories to you, and then another story as well from a disabled woman who I think makes the argument that all of these euthanasia laws are really ultimately about disability, and we have to pay attention to that as people who are pro-life. So first of all, from the Telegraph, this is a UK paper, the title of this article, the headline is, "Dying Together Was Their Deepest Wish. Couple, 91, Die in Rare Double Euthanasia." And so it's notable that, you know, both of these people are 91 years old. It's notable that they lived in the Netherlands. It's notable that they were married for 65 years. It's notable that they are both described as suffering from deteriorating physical health. You can also read there, increasing disability. And that Mr. Elder Horst, in this case, had reduced mobility following a stroke in 2012. And that his wife suffered from memory loss. And so both of these people qualified under Dutch law for euthanasia, for making the decision to terminate their own lives. However, it's certainly, certainly the question is raised that if the reason that Mr. Elder Horst was in some level allowed to take his own life, it was for genuinely physical reasons. There's no question in this article that Mrs. Elder Horst would have certainly lived well beyond Mr. Elder Horst in terms of her physical life, but that she would have become a burden to her family in ways that, frankly, it sounds like they were not willing to bear. So there was a geriatric doctor who is quoted in this piece who said, you know, this woman is mentally competent. However, if her husband were to die, she would become completely disoriented and would end up in a nursing home. So she's certainly not mentally competent in terms of that, but they regarded her as mentally competent to make a decision to take her own life. And so the lives of these two people, and again, this is being glorified and glamorized in the Telegraph, because you have sentences like this. They gave each other a big kiss and passed away confidently holding hands according to their own wishes. They were dying together. It was their deepest wish. There's a bit of a Romeo and Juliet love story that they're seeking to tell here in terms of, you know, this is idyllic. This is the way that it should go. People should be allowed to die together and die in their own time and die in their own home and die in their own hometown and die with the presence of the people who love them and die holding hands. Here's the problem. There's no question that this snatches out of the hand of God something that belongs in the hand of God and is his hand alone. So when we start talking about assisted suicide, when we start glamorizing and glorifying stories like this one, the challenge is for you to then make the argument if it's because you're probably saying to yourself, you know what, they're 91. Like, why is this not okay? At some point, is it not okay for a person to decide that they're ready to go, that they've lived, they've lived enough life? Well, what if a person who's 14 decides they've lived enough life? You say to yourself, well, that's just not true. How do you know? How do you know the days of life determined for any individual? How do you know that? You don't know that because you're not God. This is something that belongs in the hands of God, and it should not be taken out of the hands of God because really it does. It rightly belongs to him. Now, the argument against these euthanasia laws and the proliferation of them around the world, right now this is a raging debate in Australia. One of the advocacy efforts against these euthanasia laws comes from the disability community. And so we had an extended conversation here with Johnny Erickson Tata a few months back. But this particular article is actually from Liz Carr. Liz Carr is a disabled actress related to the BBC. You have got to read this. This is posted at lifenews.com. And she makes the beautiful and terrifying argument that all of these laws are really about disability, and that euthanasia laws, every single one of them, is ultimately about eliminating people with disabilities from the culture. All right, friends, that's literally all we got time for today. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, and share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.